You are listening to Fantha Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
It's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. I'm Mark Newbold, and joining me today is a man who rocks harder than a jizz whaler on Boonta Eve. It's Mark Mulcaster. Mark, how you doing, dude?
I'm very well, man. I've been rocking hard this weekend. How are you?
Absolutely fine. Busy in the Star Wars galaxy as usual, and life is busy. How about you?
Pretty busy. But that is how TV production goes. Heats and troughs. The one thing that not many people appreciate is the fact that you get booked for something way, way, way in advance, and then it gets delayed. And then you go, I have nothing to fill the void, which is good because it means I get to just sit and watch Star Wars all day. Take the rough with the smooth.
Exactly. You can rock harder than a Jizzwailer on Boonta Eve if you really want to. Loads of things to get through today. There are many events happening on May the 4th. Fantha Tracks will be at Star Wars Fan Fun Day up in Blackburn on May the 5th. But on May the 4th, we'll be at the National Space Centre for the Festival of the Force Galactic Gathering, where all sorts of people, including you and me, and during that event, played on the Saturday and on the Sunday, is a very special panel. It's a Rebels retrospective. It's looking back at 10 years of Star Wars Rebels, with Vanessa Marshall, of course, played Harrison Dula, Steve Blum, who was Zebra Alias, and Mary Elizabeth McGlynn, who was Governor Price. I'm very fortunate to have been asked to host that panel, so I'm very much looking forward to doing that. But one thing that has come along, and this is a good but, is that they would like questions from listeners and people attending and basically anyone and everyone that would love to put a question to any of those three people. So if you have a question, get your questions into news@fanthatracks.com. I'm asking you on the spot now, Mark, if you could ask any of those people a question about Star Wars Rebels, what would you ask them?
I would ask them, because Hera's been recast and Zeb is kind of in the galaxy and I guess he looks like a mo-capped character. I would ask if they could get a role in live action, what series and what role would it be?
You know, maybe that will get asked, Mark.
Little Marky Mark from Stevenage, age 10.
Oh, well, I suppose we'd better get into the news. We'll start off with some very sad news. Samantha Davis, wife of Warwick Davis, passed away. They'd been married for 35 years. She co-started Little People, the charity that they run together. Lots of people in the fandom knew her. She was ever present at Warwick's side at all sorts of events. I know, Mark, with your involvement in the Rebel Legion, you'll have seen Sam at all sorts of shows.
Yeah.
We knew she'd not been well. She'd had lots of operations. She always smiled her way through and got on with it. Terribly sad news.
She just took the words right out of my mouth. It was terribly sad. Samantha was a trooper when it came to just getting on with stuff. Like you said, the Little People charity is one that we have collected for before at National Space Centre. And we are pleased and proud that this year we will be collecting for them again. And that really is in honour of Samantha. So we're looking at running an auction on the Saturday night for the social for the members who attended that and some other things that we can do to commemorate the lovely lady. So, yeah, I mean, our thoughts obviously go out to the whole Davis family because I'm sure they are suffering 10 times worse than we are.
Yeah, there's been lots of lovely words from people across the Star Wars galaxy. Recently, Mark Hamill made mention of it and other performers that she'd met and worked with have all made comments. So, and of course, there was that article on Lucasfilm.com. Obviously, our condolences, as you say, to Warwick and the family. I think we'll all remember Sam with a big smile on our face as she always seemed to have on hers.
Hi, this is Neil Scanlan and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So fantastic news if you're a fan of John Williams and his amazing music. It's been announced in the print edition of the 2024-2025 Berlin Philharmonica Season book that John will be returning to the Philharmony Berlin on Thursday the 5th, Friday the 6th,
Saturday the 7th of June,
2025 to perform with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, which is incredible. It's within reach for most people across Europe. And if you want to travel from anywhere around the world, you can do it. It's on sale 25th of February, 2025. It's a lot of information to get out in a very short time. The most important thing, though, is that John Williams is not getting any younger, but the maestro is still getting out there, booking gigs. How cool is that we've still got John Williams getting out there with his baton waving it through the Imperial March in, how old will he be next year, 94?
You know, I'm just thinking, like, you're right. I mean, it's not a big flight for us. Wonder how much your tickets are. Might be worth a Fanford trip, you know. Fingers crossed. Didn't he have some UK dates at one point and they were cancelled recently-ish?
Recently-ish. It was 2018.
Yeah, so
it, it still feels like 5 minutes ago to me because I had tickets.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And yes, he cancelled, sadly, due to illness not that long before. And I think, if I remember, he'd been either in Berlin or in Vienna, maybe. It was more Vienna, I think he was possibly in.
I think it was, yeah.
And the concert went ahead with other conductors and they played it. I think they played it on Radio 4 and it was absolutely fantastic. And quite a big part of me wished I'd just gone anyway. He sent a message, a video message to pass on his apologies. Of course, nothing to apologise for because he wasn't well. It would have been amazing to see that. So I think, yeah.
Actually, I don't know if I want to tell the listeners when tickets going so because
I think I might have already mentioned 25th of February 2025.
Yeah,
just in my guise as a public servant for the news of Star Wars, when I really didn't want to tell anyone, so I get all the tickets for myself.
Well, exactly. You know, you could quite easily see the website crashing next year. Bad day, it's going to be 2025 in itself. It's just a ridiculous notion, anyway. So
it doesn't even sound real, does it?
No, it doesn't. It's really bizarre. I'm pretty sure it's time stopped for me in 2010. So fingers crossed it all goes ahead as planned and the maestro is there because it would be fantastic, even if me and you don't get a chance to get out there, which I hope we do. It will be something not to be missed.
Hi, this is Andy Secombe, otherwise known as a Watto, and you're listening to Fanta Tracks.
Tony Gilroy, he's the showrunner of Star Wars Andor, Season 2 coming in 2025, and this year he's just received the WGAE's Ian McClellan Hunter Award for Career Achievement. It's an award his father also won. Great honour for a writer of his calibre. Speaking about this award, in the conversation, he did mention the years that he spent in the galaxy far, far away are as meaningful to him, considering his resume, that's a hell of a thing to say, as anything he's ever done. For a writer who's done so much work and so many notable projects, to come into Star Wars and deliver a show like Andor, which is really thought-provoking. It's not for everyone. It's definitely not everybody's cup of tea. It's not action-heavy, but when it is, it's phenomenal. It's definitely a thoughtful show, and Season 2 is all set to be that and more. Do you think he means what he's saying? Do you think he really means that it's as meaningful to him as anything? Do you think that there's other works that if you caught him on another day, he might say the same about the other works? Or do you think because of the scope and the scale and the size of Star Wars and the audience that it's got and the eyes that it catches, that he really is quite correct that it's as meaningful as anything he's ever done because of the scale of Star Wars?
I mean, I've always gotten the vibe from Tony Gilroy that he doesn't mince his words and he's not likely to just blow smoke up your ass. So I think that was quite a sincere thing to say. It would have been great for whoever caught him, maybe follow up by exactly what he meant, because it's a little bit vague that what he meant by that. Is it because it's just going to be impactful for the fandom, or is it to do with the message in the actual show itself? I think it's clear to say that you can tell every single syllable is thought out in Andor, and like everything feels like it's meant to be there. A movement and an action is being discussed and thought out as to why they're doing it, not just blowing up a load of stormtroopers left, right and center just because it's cool. For me, Andor generally anyway, it could be by the end of the show the most important thing that we've seen on Disney Plus, probably even in the Disney era, when it comes to Star Wars and Star Wars storytelling.
Stepping back to the 60s, Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry, lots of messages he wanted to put on the screen, as did his writing team. And in the 60s, you couldn't be that on the nose. So you had to kind of put it behind sort of other filters. And in science fiction, you could tell any real story you want to tell in the guise of something else. So he's changing the players of the story, if you like, but he's telling a story about maybe civil rights, about the stories that he wanted to tell from a 60s point of view. He got them across in that show. Tony Gilroy right now is enough of a heavyweight that if he wanted to write a story that's bang on the nose about any given topic, he's probably got the clout to do it. But I would imagine that as a writer, especially in that world, now being given the reins to do a Star Wars show, which would seem quite linear because of where it's set and everything that's coming together to lead you up to Rogue One, which is where we leave off at the end of Andor, of course, to be able to tell stories, broader topics within that story of Andor, it's probably really attractive to a writer. I would imagine that's quite a challenge to get these messages across without bashing people around the back of the head with it.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's the thing, isn't it? It's like, even if you wanted to do a civil rights story, kind of how do you frame that in the Star Wars galaxy? Because it doesn't seem to really have been anything like that up until now. So it would be interesting to see how you would frame it. But I think it's the whole discourse behind what you think is civil liberties and the erosion of freedom of speech being taken away from you in real time. And that is quite prescient considering what is going on in the world today anyway. So I still think even with like somebody like Tony Gilroy, if you are too on the nose with these kind of things, I think people would push back a little bit, especially Star Wars fans. They have this tendency, if something smells even the slightest hint of a woke vibe, they will call it out, drag it across the town centre and set it alight, witchcraft or something. So quite interesting just to see actually whether taking Andor season two beyond the obvious big story beats of K2SO and or getting into like rebellion proper, as it were. I'm sure there's so much and so many layers that we can't even think about we're going to be seeing, that when we do see it, well, it's going to be a visual and a storytelling treat.
It really is. I think season two of Andor, whilst it's obviously got its roots in season one and everything that was set up in season one, and I would imagine we'll see many of the same characters return in season two as our main protagonists, we're now really on a pathway towards a destination of where we are in Rogue One, especially on the Rings of Khafreem when you first see Cassian. Maybe you could consider Andor season one a little bit like The Phantom Menace, which really set up the era. You kind of needed to see that young Anakin to make sense of the older Anakin going down the path he did. And so Andor now, we've seen where he came from.
Yeah.
And we've seen Rick's Road and all the things that sort of would be the bedrock of his rebellious...
Galvanizes him, yeah.
Yeah, galvanized him. So, you know, you needed that first season. I would imagine in season two, and wow, I can't wait till we're doing reaction chats about it and writing about it on the site and talk about it on the pod and everything next year. I would imagine there'll be more action. There'll be more military type stuff. We're going to see more of the mechanics of the rebellion at that point. So Rogue One makes even more sense, and it'll be an absolute must that whenever we watch that final episode next year, that the first thing you do is just what everybody did when they saw Rogue One, when they put A New Hope on. We see the final episode of Andor season two, we go and put Rogue One on. It's kind of its own beautiful little trilogy, isn't it?
It kind of really is. And I think also one thing that the first season of Andor set us up for is the three episode blocks that they're planning to tell this second season in. Yeah, because everything was pretty much in three episode blocks. Some viewers, I'll be honest, I think it took them a bit of time to get their head around that. You've got this mini slow burn series in all these stories. You know that you've got the first two, which is just ratcheting up the tension, and the third one's a release.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of go back and you do it again and you do it again. And so it'd be interesting to see how they do a similar kind of thing, but also then move the whole galaxy on by 1, 2, or 5 years. It's a completely fascinating series. And I don't think we're likely to see something like that ever again.
This is Steve Bloom, voice of Zebraelios, and you're listening to Fantha Trax Karavast. May the Force be with you.
So on this episode of Making Tracks, we've got a whole bunch of listeners' questions. We put out the call. Ooh. The call was answered. We've got four. I'm holding up five fingers on the camera, but I mean, because I'm not counting my thumb, four listeners' questions. We will start off with one from an old pal of mine, Neil Baker. He used to be on the Star Wars blogs back in the day and also did something wonderful called Turning to the Dark Side, which is a really, really awesome comic strip back when. Neil asks the question, what would be your dream tag team wrestling match in the galaxy far, far away? And what heavy metal tunes would they use for their entrances? Thank you, Neil, for that question. So if you had to pair up two characters against two other characters and they come into the ring with their heavy metal soundtracks, who would the two characters be?
Yeah, funny enough, I was going to say IG-11 and IG-88 and call them heavy metal.
Ooh.
There you go.
I like that.
Yeah, I thought
that's a good name for a tag team.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
That's really good.
I was kind of going, oh, you know, we could do maybe Prince Sizor and somebody else. And I was trying to kind of get in like the whole Nation of Domination vibe, but it's kind of like, it doesn't really work in a galaxy far, far away because you kind of have more planets and systems.
Yeah.
So two droids, I think, would be unstoppable.
On that tack, I think I would have two of the Gamorrean guards from Jabba's palace come into the ring with like all the spikes and stuff on, like Legion of Doom.
Yeah.
And the music that would be playing would be We're Not Going to Take It Anymore by Twisted Sister.
Nice.
And their tag team name would be Turning to the Pork Side.
And do you know what? It would have to be something like a tables, lightsabers and chairs match.
TLC, perfect. Thank you for that question, Neil. That is perfect. Next question from Geordie Jedi Pete at Star Wars Podcast. Just to say, Congratulations, 150 episodes. Keep it going. Yeah. He has two questions, both collectible related. First one, okay. What type of ships would you love to see the Lego UCS line do next? So we've just had the TIE Interceptor. So is there anything else that you think in the UCS line would be pretty darn nifty to come out?
One of my favorite ships has always been the B-Wing. Mm. So if I haven't done a B-Wing, I should do a B-Wing. And if I have, then we should do another one. We should do the Hera Phoenix prototype.
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't know if they have. I've not seen one. Mine would be a little bit left of center. I know they did a UCS Falcon.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see a UCS Outrider.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
Why did not? You know I was going to say that?
I just had a feeling. Although, could you imagine? That would be left of center in this day and age. Wheel out and dust off the old Shadows of the Empire.
I mean, if they did a Virago, that needs to be a Technics one, wouldn't it?
Maybe they need to do a Legends line. Lego Star Wars Legend.
You just created something out of thin air that will never 5% happen.
5% please, Lego, every sale.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
Next question again from Geordie Jedi Pete. What would you love the next Star Wars HasLab to be? And do you agree it probably needs to be smaller or cheaper than the Ghost before going bigger again with the one after this one? What would you like the next HasLab to be?
I do slightly agree with Pete. There is a problem with size and price. It does put a lot of people off. However, I think that's also kind of maybe the charm of HasLab. It's not meant to be for everyone. I would quite like, as it's a Phantom Menace 25th anniversary, either the Queen Starship.
Oh, yeah.
Which is certainly not going to be any smaller than Razorcrest.
Definitely not.
Or the Jedi Council playset, like they did from the Vintage Collection. Like over, was it six things? And you kind of joined them all together. I mean, I don't own it now, so maybe tune in next week to find out if I do by then. But I always thought it was a cool idea. I think quite fitting for 25th anniversary of a Phantom Menace.
The Queen Starship is a proper HasLab, big vehicle HasLab.
That's a big one, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, the one they released back in the day, I've got it. That's a beast.
Yeah, it's 3 foot, isn't it? I think I had it for ages. And in the end, again, I was just like, just get rid of it. Well, I mean, I sold it when I sold all my prequel trilogy collection to a German collector. So I didn't think about it. And I kind of do regret it. I mean, I always regret sending the big stuff. Kind of regret sending the Razorcrest. But hey ho, what about you? What would you suggest?
I think creatures haven't worked. They tried the Rancor with the Black Series and that never reached target. And of course, timing was against them because Book of Boba came out with the Rancor. I think if that had come out the week before, they'd have probably hit target. It would have put Rancors back in people's minds. So I think that was just a timing thing rather than Hasbro getting it wrong.
And I think if the Rancor isn't the thing, I don't know if maybe the Wampa would, but there's more dynamism to the Rancor.
Given you've mentioned the prequels, and I think there's more prequel love than people actually give credit for, certainly in the realms of collecting, a lot of nostalgia for people who are now able to buy more stuff than they probably were 10 years ago. They've got a little bit more latitude. So there's probably more love for a Geonosis Arena set of Nexu, Aklay and Reek, something like that. I think if that was done really well, could be something a bit special. I know back in the day they did make the arena as a set, which was a hell of a thing to try and do. But maybe if you had a to scale Aklay and a Kenobi figure with it, I mean, can you imagine? You know, the mouth going, it'd be the sounds, it'd be amazing.
And you would need, at a slightly higher tier, Padme Amidala can rip like her midriff off with an Exu. You know, they're like with soft goods that you can kind of rip off from that, and it's all just kind of put back on a Velcro. You could do that whole balcony, can you? You could do Dooku and Jango Fett.
Poggle
Valesa, and this party is over. Mace Windu.
Hello, I'm Ahmed Best, and you're listening to FanthaTracks.
Next question from somebody from Litchfield in Staffordshire, which is where I lived for 25 years, which is very random. Ubi Van Kenobi, great name. The question is, assuming both are flying a T-65 X-Wing and disregarding the obvious timeline differences, who would win in a friendly dogfight? Legends Wedge Antilles in his prime or Poe Dameron? That's a great question.
I'd kind of want to see the top trumps cards for both of those. Because that's the thing, is like we see more of Poe flying, and I think Poe's actual flying skills, and I think that's partly just down to production, but we're always told that like Wedge is like basically like an absolutely ace pilot, and to be fair, he survived two Death Stars and the routing from Hoth, so you can't be too bad with the old controls. So my heart says Wedge Antilles, but I just wonder if Poe might just beat him in a sim. Do one of those Rogue Squadron training sims that they spent half of the first book on. I just wonder if Poe would win. Or maybe Wedge would be a little bit more analytical.
Mm.
But then when the chips are down, Poe's going to pull out the bag. So depending on the scenario, could have two different, very different outcomes.
I see Wedge as more of a general than Poe. I know Leia was training him to be the next iteration of the Alliance leadership.
Yeah.
It's a slightly different scenario. So I don't see in those terms, you know, he is a hotshot pilot and he's inventive and yes. He's got BB-8. Wedge exactly. Didn't have a BB-8. BB-8 and Poe going together.
That's like Luke and R2, really, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. That definitely makes a difference. And it's down to visual effects techniques. You see more of Wedge flying his X-Wing in Jedi. Jedi, technically, is light years ahead of Star Wars and Empire, so there's scope to show more. But what you see of Poe, especially on Tarkadana in Force Awakens, and the opening in Last Jedi as well, of course, that's a great little sequence, is just next level. So I think as a general, as a leader, as a commander, that goes to Wedge. As a pilot who you would just send, you know, he takes down a fleet killer, as he describes it, I would give that one to Poe in that instance. And of course, Poe is way more of a central and important character to the sequel trilogy than Wedge is to the OT.
Correct,
but as you said, Wedge survived two Death Star runs and got away from the Battle of Hoth.
Taking a step away from actually canon, it's really bizarre to think that Lucas kept him around. They could have totally recast all those pilots, pilot of the day for each film. For whatever reason, Lucas keeps Dennis Lawson around and keeps him coming back, which obviously for those who were at Echo Live last weekend, you know, the Meal at the Stars was fantastic because they actually got to like chow down with Dennis Lawson. Interesting. I might have to war game that out with my Hasbro ships later on.
Final question for the day from Scariff Podcast, our buddies at Scariff Podcast. Would you guys want these new Star Wars shows to be a more standardized 50-minute episode versus the seemingly always too short 22-minute episodes? So I think he's kind of speaking to, you can have one episode of a show be an hour long and the next one be 20 minutes long. It doesn't matter. You're not stopping or breaking for adverts. You're not making a show like Next Gen in a five-act structure. There's none of those constraints. Not that you should consider them constraints. They usually help with storytelling, but nevertheless, they've got a lot more freedom. So what would you prefer? Would you rather every episode of Mando Season 4 is exactly 44, 45 minutes long, or do you feel shortchanged when it finishes after 25 minutes, or does it drag after 50?
I think the only time I really felt like, oh, really? This is such a short episode. Probably the second chapter of Mandalorian Season 1, the whole Super Star Wars assault on the Jawa Sandcrawler. That was probably the only one, and that might just have been because we weren't used to it. I would prefer that episodes run the length that they need to run for the story than have to feel like you've got to pad it out to 45 minutes or 50. Now, obviously, that just comes down to how you break your story up. If you've got a story arc and you've got certain beats, one, I don't like it when sometimes streaming kind of try to manufacture a cliffhanger for every single end of every single episode. Chances are, if you're like four episodes into like an eight episode arc, you're going to finish a thing. So I kind of feel like it's not necessarily that important. It's the same as you read a chapter of a book, and it's not like every single chapter is 20 pages long. They can be shorter or they can be longer. The Count of Elrond in the Fellowship of Rings, like 42 pages long. It's a long chapter, but then you wouldn't really split that out over two chapters. At the same time, you look at, say, something like a Dan Brown book where every other paragraph can be like a chapter, and you kind of go, that just seems a little bit excessive when a paragraph break would probably just do. I kind of think maybe there's compromise a little bit, but at the same time, I also think that we're kind of seeing with streaming, and I think actually more so that we don't give it credit for, but maybe a bit more experimental storytelling with the Star Wars shows on Disney Plus. You know, this whole notion of cutting to a whole different character for a whole episode. Before streaming TV, you wouldn't get that. They would intercut for the whole series. The makers seem comfortable to go, do you know what? We are just going to cut to Mando for two episodes in the Book of Boba Fett. Or we are going to cut to Mount Tantis for an episode of Bad Batch and then cut back to Bad Batch next week. Star Trek and that, you'd intercut all the time. It would be a little bit here, a little bit there. So I guess we'll see things develop and maybe normalize over time. But I don't feel too cheated, really, at the end of a short episode.
I don't know whether it's a budgetary thing, whether it's a creative decision. It strikes me that if you're given the latitude to make, I don't know, eight episodes of Star Wars and you write a story that when it's all blocked out and worked out is 25 minutes long and the previous episode was 45 minutes long. And again, unless budgets are a thing and they're a consideration, are you seriously telling me that with the pen in your hand and the cast and crew at your disposal, you can't make something more than 25 minutes long.
Yeah.
I know the story is important, but what you just said makes all the sense to me because, as you say, in Mando season 3, he dipped away to Coruscant with Elia Kane and with Dr. Pershing. We had that really interesting episode, which gave you a different view of what's going on in the galaxy. It takes to Coruscant, which is always a welcome place to be, and was an interesting little adventure. You've got the control of the story. Yeah. And you can't come up with another 10, 15 minutes of stuff to show us when all the tools are at your disposal. That strikes me as very odd. So it is quite jarring, I think, if you've got,
yeah,
you say Mando season 1, the first episode was 45 minutes, second episode was about 32 minutes. Mm. So your best part of a quarter of an hour less for the second episode. And it was a great episode. He goes back to the Razor Crest. He's left his ramp open like he always seems to do because people in Star Wars are idiots. He's not leaving the keys in your car. And has to chase the Sandcrawler and has that great sequence with the Sandcrawler, then goes to get the egg. Ooga, ooga, all that stuff. Opens up the furry egg. And there you go. It's an interesting episode. That would have felt like padding. So I get it.
Yeah.
But it just gets me sometimes when the disparity between episode lengths can be massive sometimes.
It doesn't seem to be like a happy medium, does it? Okay, let's make every single episode 30 minutes long, you know. But does that then mean, you know, when you're taking down the Krayt Dragon, that felt like quite a fairly lengthy episode. Now, that was quite VFX intense and heavy. And obviously, we know that the whole of Mando is one giant VFX shot on one level. Maybe there is a budgetary thing. Like you've got $250 million in the pot, and you know that if you're doing a Krayt Dragon, that's going to take $80 million, let's say. So the next episode, you want to be a little bit frugal. Okay, well, they're only really going to go from A to B. We'll just keep it short. Keep the budget down a little bit, because then also then the next episode, they're on Mandalore, and it's going to be a massive VFX show again. So it could be trading some of the budgetary constraints off. I suppose it's kind of savvy in some respects, but to your point, you know, the episode length should serve the length of the story that is required, and also that means the budget. You can get around that. If you need a character development story, you do something clever where the Razor Crest breaks down in space and may have a long heart-to-heart between him and Bo-Katan, for example, and then it costs you 50p. There are ways around it, but I suppose, like you said, it's what's going to serve the story, really. It's an interesting question that, unless we get to speak to either producers or something on one of these Star Wars shows, we'll probably never find out.
We probably never will, but before then, thank you to the four people that sent those questions in. Keep the questions coming in. We will tackle them when we have time. Thank you for those questions.
So I suppose the question is, before we head off, how do people send in listeners' questions?
Well, this is how they can do it. Visit fanthatracks.com or be sure to comment, like and share on our social media feeds at Fanthatracks. Send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@fanthatracks.com. Subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Temple for composing the Fanthatracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our making tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings, 9 o'clock UK, 4pm Eastern, 1pm Pacific, on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch, and check out our Fanta Tracks Radio Friday night rotation every Friday at 7 o'clock UK time for new episodes of the Fanta from Down Under, Planet Layer, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks, and every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time for your weekly episode of Making Tracks. And remember, FantaTracks.com, our social media feeds, Fanta Tracks TV, and Fanta Tracks Radio are absolutely free. So no Patreon, Buy Me A Coffee, Kickstarter or Indiegogo required to stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news. And that's me done for this episode.
Awesome. There you go. Well, that was a fun little episode. I enjoyed that. I love it when we get listeners' questions, especially slightly left-of-field listeners' questions as well. So, you know, ask them. Keep them coming. We love them. We will be back very, 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 very soon. Until then, stay safe, everybody. And, of course, may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on Fanta Tracks Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.